You're listening to the Mythgreen Podcast with your hosts, Oren Ashkenazi, Wes Matlock, and Chris Winkle. There was a castle by a waterfall with a pink and purple wall and a princess living there. She had no parents and was all alone. She got by on her own and she liked it pretty well. Cause she never wore socks, she had a pet snake, she bought a red guitar and she ate a whole cake. And there wasn't anybody there to tell her what to do, so she did what she wanted to. Everybody knew the story of the princess who saved herself.
This episode is brought to you by our patron, Kathy Ferguson, professor of political theory in Star Trek.
This is the Mythgreen Podcast. I'm Chris, and with me is...
Wes.
And...
Oren.
And today, we discuss the vampire. That, as Andrew would say it on Buffy, in any case.
I think we need to pronounce everything with, like, a weird accent, like, we want to discuss the vampire, right? I think that's required in this episode.
Yes.
Dracula accent.
I am really amused that that one of the foundational vampire stories does the whole, like, what we now consider pretentious misspelling.
The why not I?
yeah, Dr. Polidori's The Vampire, spelled with a Y, because that makes it, like, creepier. I actually don't know if that's why he did it. Maybe back then there was just not standardized spelling of vampires. But it is interesting to me that when I looked at for my research, the first thing I asked was, when did vampires get sexy? And I see people Googling that all the time, and the answer is they were always sexy.
Yeah, no, that makes sense.
Both vampire and then the next like really well-known one, Carmella, are both sexy vampire stories, and they're not like the first vampire stories, but they are considered like the foundation of the genre. And they were always sexy. In fact, there was a weird point in, like, around the Nosferatu period where they kind of stopped being sexy for a little while. But then they became sexy again very quickly. Mm-hmm. They've always been sexy, people. You can stop Googling.
Yeah, I mean, I read some of the original Dracula, and, you know, it wasn't overt, but there was definitely undertones throughout about that. I mean, overt in the beginning. I think it gets more overt. Much more of it later.
Yeah.
Like, Dracula is actually distinctly less sexy than the vampire stories that came before. Dracula is the more mainstream version with a lot of the smut cut out. Or at least that's my impression from looking at the stories as they were published.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I remember digging more into the sexiness of it myself for reasons. I mean, Oren, you brought up Polidori's The Vampire, and that was based off of a fragment that Lord Byron had written, and it's literally called Fragment of a Novel, sometimes called The Burial. And Polidori, like, had read that and then went and did The Vampire, kind of inspired by what Lord Byron wrote. But fun fact, The Vampire of Polidori is based on Lord Byron himself. And so Lord Byron is classically known as being a rather handsome guy, a very pale complexion with dark features, who was quite a lady killer, apparently. Also a monster, a horrible, horrible piece of human trash. And it's from him that, like, people took, like, that model from Polidori and, like, others of, like, you know, kind of the wan, like, sexy but, like, brutal person that, like, just only, like, sought pleasure and didn't care what he did to, like, other people's lives.
So why aren't more vampires poets then? That's my question. This seems like a really obvious misstep.
Yeah, considering the Anne Rice model, you know, which I think considered modern day writers to make them a lot more angsty, you would think that more vampires would be poet. The only one I can think of is Spike from Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
I wonder if that was a nod to Byron by making Spike a poet. I had never considered that before.
Interesting.
Yeah, although Spike is different though, because his vampire persona, you wouldn't know that he's a poet. You find out he's a poet by looking at his backstory when he's like a dorky human, and he's like a bad poet. Right? So that doesn't seem to be very Byron inspired, but who knows?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's just that, like, they, you know, the important part of Spike's background is that he was a loser before he became a vampire, right? Mm-hmm. It's, like, not super important that it was poetry. That's just what they picked. So, like, I kind of wonder if maybe that was a nod. It was like, yeah, you know, the origins of the vampire in fiction are really tied into Byron. We need Spike to be a loser at something. We'll have it be poetry, you know, like a little inside joke. Yeah. I have no idea if that's true. It's just that's what I would do if I was them.
Interesting.
Yeah.
The angstiness definitely seems to come as a trait of vampires transitioning into being protagonists instead of villains.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because looking at a number of early vampire stories, the protagonists are extremely angsty, but they're not vampires. But they're still extreme. Like, the protagonists are people dealing with vampires, and they are extremely angsty. Is it Vampyr? One of the early vampire stories, the conflict is that the main character, like, promised not to tell anybody that he saw the vampire guy die, and then so when the vampire guy comes back, he is, like, seducing the guy's sister and is gonna kill her, he, like, can't tell anyone because he promised, and he angsts a lot about it for a big part of the book. And it's like, or you could just tell somebody, I don't think anyone's gonna hold you too responsible for breaking your promise under these circumstances.
You know, that's a good point. And I don't, what is the, is, did anybody find anything prior to Anne Rice about, like, the angsty protagonist vampire that feels bad about drawing blood?
No, I tried to look, and I mean, Interview with a Vampire, that came out like in the 70s, right? The mid 70s. And prior, between like Stoker's Dracula and that, I couldn't find a ton besides like the Bela Lugosi film and Nosferatu, mm-hmm. right? Like that, and they certainly aren't filled with angst.
a little known side entry into the genre that I've always enjoyed, which I think is after Anne Rice. I should have looked up the publishing dates on this, but I think it's after Anne Rice, is George R. R. Martin's Fever Dream. Or otherwise known as Vampires on a Steamboat.
Ooh. And
yeah, and, like, I enjoyed it. It's a story about a steamboat captain who, like, is down on his luck, and then some rich dude is like, hey, I'm gonna buy you a steamboat if you'll be the captain of it. And he's like, that sounds great. There's nothing suspicious about this guy at all. And it turned out that there was something suspicious about him, because he was a vampire.
A vampire.
But he's actually a good vampire, it turns out. This was the earliest book I've ever read that featured a good guy vampire. And I think it is after Interview with a Vampire came out, but mm-hmm. He wasn't super angsty, but he was sort of he was like a vampire philosopher, and he was like, maybe vampires could learn to live in peace with humans. And he was only sabotaged by the fact that every vampire except him is a dick. That was like his major problem with his philosophy, is that he was like, oh, I guess we're all assholes, so that's not gonna work.
Yeah, that's like True Lies.
Mm-hmm.
In, at least I haven't read any of the books it's based on. Not True Lies. That's the not the wrong name. The HBO series?
True Blood.
Yeah.
True Blood. True Lies is a different movie. Vampire series where supposedly, like, the main character likes vampires and wants to help them because they're supposedly all oppressed, but, like, they're all jerks, so it's hard to empathize with them or want them to have more rights or something.
Mm-hmm.
Right, that's the weird thought. I mean, like, True Blood even has a character who is very similar to the dude from Fever Dream. He shows up later, and I call him Vampire Jesus because he, like, wants to make peace between humans and vampires, and will literally wants to die for the sins of all the other vampires. And, like, he is kind of the same thing, and he is also sabotaged by the fact that all the other vampires are dicks.
Hmm.
And it's hard to be like, we deserve to be treated better when we're constantly murdering people. That's like that's a hard argument to make.
Oh, God. Yeah. Yeah.
It's difficult to have large populations of vampires in a story, right? Like, it opens up a lot of questions about, you know, how do they actually get on? And if you want vampires to be scary, you have to answer, okay, so we have a large population of vampires. They would be eating a lot of people if even, mm-hmm. like, a small percentage of them mm-hmm. are willing to eat humans. How does that work? And it's interesting when for the stories that decide to just go all the way and be like, yes, this is, we are now exploring the world where vampires have completely taken over and humans are scarce. Have you guys seen Daybreakers?
I have not, no.
Yeah, so Daybreakers is under the premise that vampires have won. Okay, and so humans are now very scarce and vampires rule, and the human blood supply is hoarded, and basically the vampires that don't get access to human blood turn into like bat monster creature things. You know, okay. So there's a, they have a large poor population that can't get a hold of human blood because humans are really rare now.
Yeah, that's why you got to practice sustainable farming, vampires. It's not going to look pretty otherwise.
Yeah. And it has some interesting things like cars that are designed to like shield the sunlight that you can like drive around during the day, et cetera, et cetera. But it's also just, it's such a gratuitous movie because it decides to, it's going to make this mechanic where they find, discover a method of making vampires into humans again. And then if you drink the blood of a vampire that's been turned into a human, you also turn into a human. And so they have this, the most ridiculous sequence I've ever seen at the end of the movie where like all these, you have tons and tons of ravenous vampires, right? Because humans are super scarce and they're all hungry. So like they feed off of one vampire turned human and then they turn into humans. And then all the vampires around them are like, oh, you're delicious now. And then attack, eat them. And then they turn into humans. And then the vampires around them are like, hmm. And you just,
it's
the most ridiculous sequence, like violent, gratuitous sequence of like, you know, consecutive vampires turning into humans and getting eaten. That is where that movie goes.
Interesting.
That sounds amazing.
Yeah.
And I'm super into that. Although that actually brings me to another point about vampires that is not so much about their food, but about their power level and their weakness to sunlight. So like it's interesting because True Blood actually shows both of these problems. Is that once you make a vampire like a certain level of powerful, it's like they just get kind of boring. And True Blood has this problem where its vampires are basically superheroes in terms of like they're like the Flash and Superman combined. They're like super fast and super strong. And so, like, one vampire can probably fight an army of humans. It's, like, it's kind of ridiculous. But at the same time, it also shows that vampires are being, like, dying in sunlight is such a ridiculous weakness that they are really easy to kill if you put your mind to it. So, yeah, like, if all you need to do is find out where they sleep. And if you've ever played a role-playing game where your characters are hunting vampires, you know this is a problem. Because it's frankly just not that hard to expose a vampire to sunlight if you really set your mind to it. So that's one of the reasons why I generally prefer vampires who do not die in sunlight and are not super powered, because then, like, otherwise it's still, there's not really any fighting of vampires to be had. It's like, do you meet a vampire at night? Okay, the vampire wins. Do you meet a vampire during the day? Okay, you win. And then it's like this weird, like, it's almost like a nuclear standoff. It's like, who attacks first? You know, it's like, do we attack first at night or during the day? And it's like, it's just a weird dynamic. And I don't think, like, I mean, you can generally get away with it outside of role-playing games because people have just accepted that that's the premise of a lot of vampire stories. But that will cause a real issue if you're doing a role-playing game with players who, like, actively think about their tactical situation, right?
I think the strain does a pretty good job, the TV show. Their vampires are weak to sunlight and UV rate. They're not like, they're not super powerful. They're actually, the lower level vampires are actually more like zombies than they are like vampires. But they are hard to kill. And so, and they're, and like zombies, they have largely strength in numbers at their lower levels. And so then at night, the main characters that are getting swarmed, they try to keep up their UV light. And again, it also helps if it's not like you expose them to UV radiation and then they just like explode. It's not really much of a fight most of the time. And it's, you know, established that during the day they're all crowding down in the sewers. So it's really, you know, like in very large numbers. And so sometimes the characters do go down in the sewers But, you know, they have to make sure their lights are enough for the huge hordes of vampires under there, so...
Right. Hmm. Well, like, the strain also has another wrinkle, if I recall correctly, which is that the vampires spread, like, an actual disease. Like, they don't spread exclusively by biting, if I recall correctly.
Yeah, yeah. So they have various vectors, so they will spread by biting, but they also can spread in other ways as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Although, even in that situation, like, here, let me tell you what PCs would do if you describe that situation to them. They would be like, okay, we break open the top of the sewers. Like, they wouldn't go down into the sewers. They'd be like, why would I go in there? That's full of zombie vampires. Instead, they would just find the area above the sewers and just knock a hole in it. And, like, let the sunlight in. Obviously the characters in the show don't do that. But, you know, and that's fine. That, like, the show can work with that premise. But, like, if you put that scenario before the PCs, they will get out their excavation equipment. And it will not be pretty.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's a good point. In the show, it gets to the level... of, I think, is it New York City? Gets to the level where, you know, you basically have city council members addressing this problem, right? We're, mm-hmm. like, on a systemic city level. And so you'd think that it's like, okay, we have a serious vampire problem in the city. It's actually probably worth it to demolish large portions of the city to expose the sewers or just explode the sewers to get rid of them.
Mm.
Although I think they do a good job in the show of demonstrating that, like, the wealthier, more isolated neighborhoods with enough money manage to keep themselves relatively safe.
Well, like always, class is the real enemy.
Yeah.
the real monster is capitalism.
I suppose I was just thinking, in defense of the sunlight weakness, I was trying to think what, for me, makes vampires scary. And honestly, if I'm thinking about it more from, like, reading a book or like watching a show, I don't like so much all like the super like powered stuff that they have. I'm fine with, like, you know, the being strong and being fast, but basically I kind of just want them to be menacing monsters. But the most powerful thing that I like about them that happened in like stories with like singular vampires and sunlight weaknesses is the true power of like influence. I like the mm-hmm. idea that they're like master manipulators and they just have that kind of like charisma that like can get basically create thralls like without even biting them. One of the scariest parts for me in one of my favorite vampire stories is Stephen King's Salem's Lot, where basically, have you guys read that?
I've seen the miniseries a while ago.
The book is great because, yeah, I mean, the vampire, you do get FaceTime with him, but not a lot, because I think in Dracula he was named Renwick, but I think that that's kind of like a, you know, a name.
Renfield, yeah.
But like the Renfield in Salem's Lot is way more terrifying than the vampire ever is, because he just has full access to the town while like everybody's awake during the day. And he's got some like pact with the vampire where he can like drink a little vampire blood, which starts making him a little unhuman without becoming a full vampire. And just like how the main characters deal with that guy first and foremost. And then at night, of course, the vampire gets to come out and raise hell. So like, I like solo vampires. I think they're scarier when they're solo, that start to like spread their influence. And then you don't really know like what they've put their fingers into in terms of like control in like a small town or something like that.
No, absolutely.
I think it's better. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like the inverse ninja rule. Like pretty much everything, every type of monster, anything follows the inverse ninja rule, where the more of them there are, the less impressive they are, the less intimidating they are, the less competent they are, the less scary they are. And it, with vampires in particular, watched Blade 2 recently.
Yes.
And Blade 2, it you know, you've got Blade, he's got his normal vampire opponents, but no, there's a new kind of vampires, which I actually didn't realize this. I should have, because they're both by Del Toro, but this is actually the origin of the strain vampires is in Blade 2.
Oh.
Yeah, and... So we've got these new, more powerful version of vampires. And at first, you know, the idea is like, oh, they're really hard to kill and intimidating, gross. But then, of course, when there's a horde of them, now they're just, you can just mow them down, right? They're just,
right.
One of them is intimidating, you know, a bunch of them are easy. So it's just always scarier if you just make one. Just mm-hmm. make one. And then the minions are such a good idea because in order to keep something scary, you've got to escalate. You've got to have somewhere to go. And so giving the vampire lower level minions means that you can make those minions scary. And then once your protagonists tackle the minions, now they can deal with an even scarier threat. Whereas if they are directly coming across the vampire, there's no way that you can keep, at least for a full novel, that you can keep the vampire scary that entire time.
Mm-hmm.
And leave your protagonists like unharmed.
Yeah, my favorite part of Blade 2 is that they are trying to figure out how to kill these new super vampires, and they establish early that they have UV lights that do it, UV flashlights, and then they never use them again and spend the rest of the movie trying to figure out how to kill these vampires. And it's like, you had that one scene where you killed it with a UV light? No, okay, never mind. that's my favorite part of Blade 2. But I think, like, the making vampires rare solves so many problems and is particularly good for vampires. Like, in general, I agree that making, like, any monster can suffer from inverse ninja theory, but vampires in particular really benefit from being uncommon for, like, a bunch of reasons. One is, frankly, believability. It's way easier to accept if you're doing a vampire story with a masquerade. It's way easier to accept that one vampire with a lot of influence can cover up the occasional victim, right?
Yeah.
It's like, it's like the vampire has servants in the police and in City Hall and in the records. And yeah, like occasionally people disappear and those are some of the people the vampire ate. Like, it's one vampire. We can, you know, that they need to eat what, like one person every 6 months or so? Yeah, we can cover that up. but like when you have a civilization of vampires, it's a little bit like, that's a little bit harder to swallow. You guys have already covered the whole question of, like, of escalation and having minions that the vampire grants powers to. I'm all about that. Like, having the vampire be, like, a spider at the center of a web.
Yeah.
That I'm a huge fan of. I also just, from a world-building perspective, I think vampires would be very careful about who they turn, because once you turn someone, you have to spend eternity with them.
Yep.
You know, like, do you really want to? And, like, turning someone also risks creating a rival, and there's, like, only so, like, vampires are kind of like big apex predators, right? Like, there's, like, a territory can only support so many vampires. So, like, I like the idea that vampires don't just turn anybody they find, right? Like, if they want to turn you, it must be for a very specific reason, and, like, they see it as, like, an investment.
Mm-hmm. I think most worlds that have it so that the vampire will end up turning, or could turn anybody they bite instead of anybody they actually decide to turn, usually they have some sort of hierarchy so that somebody who's bitten, they technically turn, but they don't turn into the same kind of powerful vampire that the antagonist is.
Yeah.
You know, they turn into sort of a lower level monster. And then it takes, you know, either a really long lifespan or something else before they become, you know, the classical vampire.
Yeah, that's a good point. I think that idea maybe came from Stoker's Dracula, because, right, he gets, when Dracula actually gets to England and he starts feeding on this woman that they're, like, several men are kind of courting, and they just think that they don't know why she's, like, losing blood in her sleep. But then, like, at night when she finally, like, comes up, she's, like, not, I mean, she's trying to, like, manipulate them and, like, attack them, but she doesn't really have any agency at all, right? She's basically a corpse that's, like, kind of, like, fueled by, like, whatever, like, infection Dracula, like, put into her. There's just no real, like, vampire. It's kind of a drained corpse that can, like, come to life and you know, try to kill people.
Yeah, certainly, because again, otherwise you would just have Daybreakers, right?
Yes.
Which was an interesting thing for a movie to explore, but I think when most of us are designing vampires, we don't really want
yeah, that's a very specific scenario. Like having like a big, like, vampire society, like, you know, again, like what they have in White Wolf vampire games, it's like, I'm just not into it. It's like, the like, if you have, like, if I was going to play a vampire, I would still want vampires to be like really rare, mm-hmm. because then like I can kind of individualize and play my vampire however I like.
Mm-hmm.
But like one of the reasons why I can't ever get into a World of Darkness vampire game is that like everyone that I know gets by preying on humans, and even if I decide to play a weird vampire who like doesn't do that, I'm still like hanging out with everyone who does, right? Like, you know, it's not like they are indirectly benefiting from a system that marginalizes people, or like in real life, it's like they go out every night and suck and attack people and suck their blood. And I'm just like, I can't live with these people. I just can't. You know, I'm not willing to be friends with them.
Yeah.
And so like that's one of the reasons why I can't get into a vampire, like, you know, White Wolf vampire game. Whereas in Chris's game that she's running right now, one of our characters is a vampire, but she's handling it much better. And I would, you know, if she'd picked me to be the vampire, I would not have been upset.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I mean, I think it's important if, again, in this situation, everybody's playing a monster, but I specifically chose which monsters each player would become.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, my players gave me permission to do that. And I gave mm-hmm. them the option to pick their own monsters. But I think the important part is that, you know, not really forcing anybody to be a evil predator, right?
Yeah.
Like she fights against hunger. Like she bit like one guy.
One
briefly.
One air quotes guy. I'm not getting over this.
All right. Inside game references aside. But yes, Chris is, that is exactly correct.
Yes.
It's harder to do with vampires than it is with other creatures because, like, the whole blood-sucking thing is, like, really inherently tied to vampires. In fact, like, you could argue that feeding off of another being is what defines a vampire.
Mm-hmm.
Like, even if you have them, like, for example, in Lost Girl, they technically call them fae, but they're all just different flavors of vampire, right? Like, they all feed on something.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it's blood, sometimes it's sex energy. You know, I forget what all the other things are, but, you know, there's a lot of different ones. I'm a fan of time vampires, personally. Vampires that steal your time.
Age, basically.
Yeah, they age you. Mm-hmm. I think that's kind of neat, but then it's kind of an edge case.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like, unlike other monsters that can kind of coexist with humans, vampires have that thing that you kind of have to figure out. It's like, okay, this is a really big part of vampires, and how does that manifest in your setting?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I would say because vampires have been done for so long and have appeared in so many stories, just one of the biggest things for anybody doing vampires is just look for a way to make them fresh. Mm-hmm. And we even have a post Oren wrote on making a fresh vampire antagonist that talks about some of the things that he was saying about good world building with vampires. But I think it really makes a big difference to just make them different in some way, like the strain does. Again, they're not, if you don't make them fresh, it's gonna be hard for them to have an impact in any direction, including being scary. And even Twilight made vampires that were in many ways very different from the traditional vampire, even if it's silly things like sparkling in the sun. Although, apparently Twilight is not as original as I thought, because it's eerily similar to both Vampire Diaries and True Blood, and apparently they both predate the books that mm-hmm. predate Twilight.
Interesting.
But certainly the vampires being like stone, because they're cold and hard like stone, apparently, and smooth like stone.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Hmm.
And like sparkling in the sun and other things are definitely, like, as far as I know, Twilight specific.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. Right, although it's interesting, okay, so, like, making them like stone is something that is, like, the sparkling thing, everybody knows that about Twilight vampires because it's been, you know, because it feels so obviously silly and it's been, like, repeated a bunch, but, like, the stone thing, I think even if you, like, read part of Twilight, you might not have noticed that. It's not super iconic, so, like, I would also say if you're looking for a way to make your vampire, you know, distinctive and stand out, don't just, like, give them random traits.
Right.
It's like, my vampires are different because they smell like roses. And it's like, okay, that is different, but it's just a random trait you gave them, right? It doesn't feel particularly thematic to vampires.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Which, I mean, I would suggest then, like, rooting, if you're gonna do a story with a vampire, like, it's okay to draw on tradition and root it in like the essentials of a vampire story and then spread out from there accordingly. But basically, I mean, I don't know, like Dracula was so influential, but it drew on a longer tradition of, if we broke it out into like much more broad terms, there's some older figure that represents corrupt, outworn historical values that aren't relevant anymore, who interacts with a young person that represents kind of like new ideas, optimism, hope. And then the older figure systematically strips away like the energy, life force, and virtue of the younger one, which sustains it and results in kind of like the corruption or death of like the younger one. And so you don't need like actual like blood sucking to make that happen. Like what Oren was talking about, the different types of fae. You just need, I mean, you could do that with like in a political story. It'd be just fine. I mean, I'm sure there's been plenty of them, but I think that like that like conflicting nature of like the old irrelevant somehow still like being able to steal from like the new is what is scary, right? It's like a perpetuation of like corrupt systems in a way that like is the horror of the tale.
Well, once again, the true monster is capitalism.
Yes.
Okay, I know it doesn't feel like it, but we are actually at our time. Yeah. it turns out vampires are a big subject. Who knew? Maybe you have to do Vampires Part 2 someday. All right, do either of you have any final thoughts you want to close with on vampires?
Go read Robert Brown's Porphyria's Lover. It's a short poem, and it's vampiric, but not necessarily about a vampire, but it's terrifying.
Oh, exciting. Very nice, very nice.
I guess I would recommend, there's a American and a foreign version. Oh, I'm trying to remember where the foreign version is from, but Let the Right One In.
Yeah. Yeah, that's creepy.
Yeah, like, it doesn't actually change vampires that much. It's just unique because it's about a human boy encountering a child vampire. And it's just, it makes it very feel very unique just because of the perspective it comes from.
Mm-hmm. All right, excellent. Well, thank you for talking to me about this. Those of you at home, if anything we said piqued your interest, you can email us at podcast@mythgreens.com. Otherwise, we will talk to you next week.
Treat your friends to an evening of dark ritual murder. In a fictional game scenario, of course. The Voyage is a standalone RPG full of spooks and frights. For sale on mythcreants.com. There was a dragon with a pointy tail. He was bigger than a whale and his breath was terrible. He scared the princess when he came around. Tried to burn the castle down, but she caught him by his tail. Then she tied him to a tree so the dragon couldn't fly. She told him he was mean and it made the dragon cry. When he finally every weekend with the princess who saved herself.
This has been the Mythgreant Podcast. Opening closing theme, The Princess Who Saved Herself, by Jonathan Colton.